Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that doesn't exactly have its hands on the interest rate levers. We'll leave that to other people. I'm Scott Phillips, and as always, with me is Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Captain. How are you?
Mate, I'm excellent as always. Mate, any better I'd be twins, as I like to say. mate, we've got a busy podcast. We've got a little bit of macro news to get through before we get to our favourite segment, the mailbag. We'll talk a little bit about some company news, an IPO in the US that is going to keep you on the seat of your pants. That's a bit of a pun there. Stay tuned. And you might give us a little bit of a rant, I think. We did discuss a possible high horse earlier. So if we have time, if you have the motivation and the interest, we'll see what you've got for your high horse. But let's start with the macro, buddy. So the big news this week comes out of the US, as it always does. And for once, thank God, it's not Donald Trump. It is Jerome Powell, or Jay Powell, as the cool people like to say, people who think they know him. He's the chairman of the US Federal Reserve, and he's put the kibosh on further rate rises for at least this year. That's something of a climb down from where the Fed was only three or four short months ago, mate. What's going on? Is Donald Trump in his ear? Has the data changed? Is he getting a little bit of cold feet? Why is the US not going to raise rates?
Yeah, so, I mean, a few months back, maybe three, 4 months back, as you said, he was saying there are going to be a couple more rate rises. Now he's saying that the most likely course is to stay flat.
Mm-hmm.
And the culprit, it seems, is the world economy.
But come on, none of that's new news,
right?
The
world economy is not growing fast enough.
What's changed? Nothing's changed. This is if you look around the world, you said if we asked this question in December and said, well, Australia's muddling along, Europe's a bit flat, China's kind of still growing, but it's slowing rates, Brexit's still going on. I don't reckon anything's changed in the last 3 months, but his tone's changed meaningfully.
Yeah, I think maybe the fact that, you know, the trade war is still ongoing, nothing has been resolved. Europe is still in a funk. You know, maybe he's feeling that the rate rise would affect the U.S. and therefore he's saying, well, you know, we've got to watch the data and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. But again, that hasn't changed though.
Well, it hasn't changed. But I mean, I think, you know, they did a couple of rate rises, right? Their unemployment there still is pretty low. And maybe he's just fearful that, you know, he might stoke the wrong button here and cause, cause a slowdown in the economy. So
nobody wants to be the central banker who causes a recession, right?
Yeah, he doesn't want to be that. And, you know, maybe there's some politics here. I don't know.
Now,
politics could always be at play.
Chairman Mahanty?
Yes.
Jerome Powell's on leave. You're in charge. Are you sticking with no rate rises in 2019, or would you be tempted to push the little up lever a bit further?
I would have pushed up. That was what I would have done. But
and why?
What do I know? Well, I think that, you know, we have had easy monetary policy for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and that can create lots of bad habits in people's minds and in businesses and so on. So I think, you know, the economy in the US is really strong. I would have used that to maybe increase maybe rate by one more time at least. So that's what I would have done.
I would too. I'd also be increasing rates here in Australia, by the way, but that's a whole different question. Mate, we'll get back to the Australian macro, but before we do, so let's stay international a little bit. The other big international news this week was that Brexit is kind of suspended. That's not going to catch on, is it?
Hasn't been suspended for a long time.
No, Will Porter, our producer, shaking his head at me, thinking I really shouldn't be on radio with that sort of stuff. Probably fair too, mate. We'll re-record this later. It'll never go to air. So it's been pushed back, apparently. The Europeans are playing hardball. The UK opposition is playing hardball. Theresa May, for the millionth time I've seen a headline, Theresa May as PM's got to go, da-da-da. She seems to be clinging on for dear life, but Brexit's been pushed back. Oh, have you seen a more dysfunctional political... Well, I suppose it's a high bar, right? There's plenty of those. But I can't remember anything as... I'm trying to even think of the right word. Dysfunctional is the best word I can come up with. It's kind of just a bit of a debacle, isn't it?
It looks like a complete mess is what I can... And, you know, I really don't understand what the core issues here are. I mean, the EU is going to make it hard for them to leave.
Yeah.
That we always
need. Which it has to, right? Because all the other countries will decide they want to leave.
Everyone else will start leaving, right?
Right.
I mean, that completely makes sense. And I don't know how they can expect to get easy terms or terms that, you know, it works for them, you know, that makes it, again, as you say, easy for everyone else to leave. So I don't know what they can expect. So I don't know what their member of parliaments want. And
They want out, but they want all the good stuff. It's a Clayton's exit, right? We want to leave the European Union, but have all of the benefits. It's kind of like you can't have your cake and eat it, can you? That's kind of
that's what it is.
101 stuff.
Yeah.
Mate, investing-wise, I mean, it's been dragging on forever, seemingly. We've kind of been waiting for the next shoe to drop. How do you think about Brexit when it comes to your investing?
I'd be cautious about stuff. You know, exposure to UK financial services is a worry region. Otherwise, I mean, I think it'll sort itself out. I mean, it's not a huge component of my thinking process, and I think a lot of our companies, some of them have UK exposure, but not a lot of them.
Right.
So I think it's not a big deal. Mm. But you know, again, there might be the other flow-on effects that I haven't considered.
We'll see. All right, mate, let's move on. I completely agree with what it's worth. I think this is going to be one of those things. I mean, remember when the Brexit vote itself came out and the markets dropped, almost like 7%, something stupid in the UK. It was a non-event. I think it'll continue to be a non-event. I don't really see it being a big issue either way. Mate, so let's come home. Let's finish off our quick race around the world with a bit of Australian macro and some good news from Australia. Unemployment falls to 4.9%.
Record.
Not bad for a country that's, in theory, apparently, so the speculators say, in some sort of economic trouble, is it? I mean, geez, what more do you want? Low inflation, low unemployment, growth's okay, interest rates are low. It's the promised land, isn't it?
Absolutely. Is it, what, 8-year record?
Something like that.
And
pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, again, the numbers are great. I think the only thing to note is that most of the jobs were part-time.
Yeah.
Not enough full-time jobs, but hey, I mean, there's nothing there to complain about.
Fair to say, too, the participation rate did fall in the month, yeah. So that did bring the number down. It's always easier if you've got a smaller denominator, as the mathematicians like to say. In other words, if you've got a smaller base of people you're comparing against, if there's fewer people in that list, of course, your percentage is going to come down. But broadly speaking, it's been going up over time, so it's not unreasonable to think it would move around a little bit. Some big, big moves by state I saw too. WA unemployment apparently came down almost one percentage point, something ridiculous, which I expect will probably be a sampling error, at least in part, rather than a real number. In any case, though, it's tempting to think that the Australian economy might be heading for some sort of trouble, but geez, we're looking pretty good in the meantime.
I thought the numbers were really good. Yeah, I mean, if in such numbers, you know, nothing to complain about.
Mate, now speaking of complaining about numbers...
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's look at poor old TPG. I'm old enough to remember, and you don't have to be that old to remember, by the way, the days when the go-go days when telcos were all the rage. Telstra was at $6, Vocus was at $9, TPG, I want to say, got to $12 or $13. Fair to say, none of those companies are at those prices at the moment. It's been a decent come down for these guys. In fact, TPG's results out during the week, revenue actually fell.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long way back from the kind of the double digit growth days of kind of, you know, telcos printing money. The company's saying, well, our margins are down because of the NBN and our prices are down because of the NBN and things are a bit tough. I think it's unquestionable now, surely, that telcos have gone from go-go growth tech stocks to basic utilities with utility-like sales and profit growth. And in fact, profits under pressure because margins keep falling on the back of the NBN. Where does that leave TPG, mate, and the rest of the telco sector? Is this utility land? Is this low, regular, stable returns? Is there a return to growth? Or maybe do things get worse before they get better?
I think the telco land is mostly a utility land. Like, right. I mean, you know, it's a utility that we need. It's a utility that, you know, we can't live without. But, I mean, there's a lot of competition, not enough growth, right?
And I'm going to stop you actually for a sec. I'm sorry to do this halfway through. I'm going to define my terms because I didn't do a very good job for our listeners who might be thinking, utility what? What's a utility? It's a Stanley knife, utility knife or something. When we talk about utilities, we're talking about those businesses or organizations that are there to provide basic services for society. And normally we think a utility would be a water company, electricity company, increasingly telecommunications as we're talking about. But those kind of ubiquitous services that we all use and rely on, gas pipelines, for example, might be another one. We call them utilities and they generally have certain characteristics. They tend to be low growth because once everyone in the country's got a phone line or an electricity cable or a gas main or a water line, there's only so much growth you can get out of that. And so what you end up with utility companies is pretty pedestrian, you know, small amounts of growth, effectively in line with population, maybe a bit of pricing growth if costs go up or something else, and relatively stable profits. And they tend to give relatively stable dividends as a result because these are kind of, they're almost term deposit proxies, right, at some level. And they shouldn't be ever considered that safe. But at some level, that's kind of what we talk about when we talk about utilities. So, mate, I wanted to do that. What was my bad in the beginning? So now with that out of the way, I'll let you go back to TPG is now a utility, you say?
TPG is a utility. I mean, you know, the thing is that unlike Telstra, TPG doesn't pay a healthy dividend, right? So if you're buying TPG, you're expecting growth.
Yep.
But I don't know where the growth comes from. So that I think that's the issue with having TPG. Mm. I mean, TPG also is trying to merge with Vodafone, right? So, I mean, or Hutchison Telecommunications.
Yes.
As it is called. So I don't know. Like, I mean, it's going to be, you know, the go-go days, I think, are far behind us. Mm-hmm. Maybe the next stage is when 5G comes. I just have a hard time seeing how 5G is going to materially change. Materially change the revenue dynamics for them, right? I mean, revenue fell, 2.5-3%, something like that.
Yep.
I don't know how the revenue goes back to growing.
I'll say 1.7, I think, but in any case.
Okay. Some small.
Small but meaningful.
Small but meaningful. I mean, the operating profit went up because, you know, some other things happened. I just don't see how even 5G changes the dynamics. I mean, everybody who wanted to have, who has a phone and has a network, you know, has data plans and so on, has got it, right? They're going to ask for more. Maybe there's going to be some growth, but I mean, you know, it's very hard to see how the growth is going to be like spectacular. So, and we have to also remember that a lot of the growth came from acquisitions, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And in the past.
Right, IINet, Pipe Networks before that.
Then there was Vocus merged with
M2. After buying Amcom before that.
I mean, you know, there was a lot of consolidation that happened in that space. And you know, I just can't see how the Competition Commission is going to allow any further consolidation.
I think
right?
this one's it. In fact, TPG is shutting down their mobile plans in Canberra.
Yeah.
In theory, they're saying because of a supplier issue, which I'm sure is true. And certainly, I don't want the defamation lawyers coming after me, so let's assume it's true. It also doesn't hurt that it would remove some overlapping infrastructure with Vodafone, which might have earned the ACCC's ire. Mate, you mentioned 5G, so just before we move on, I do want to ask about that. The big hope for telcos was kind of 5G specifically, but more the Internet of Things in general. There's been this hype about internet-connected devices. Everything's going to be internet-connected with a SIM card in it, whether that's vending machines or tractors or, I don't know, air conditioning units or, you know, the whole idea that everything, you know, new machinery, new devices, everything was going to be internet-connected because it was going to allow us to have better information, more responsive devices. I said everything from a tractor driving around a field in parks through to the local vending machine to let you know when it was full. To the extent that's kind of still apparently a thing, and that should, in theory, have, if it does happen, we should see multiples of the number of devices connected now, right? You're right. Everyone's got a phone. Everyone's got a home broadband, or almost everybody. At some point, though, if every kind of dumb device becomes a smart device, some will be Wi-Fi connected. But those that aren't, you should a doubling or tripling of the number of connected devices in the next 5 or 10 years. I mean, that's got to be worth something to the telcos, doesn't it?
Yeah. So in the good old days, this used to be called, you know, the machine-to-machine
communication. That's my line, dude, the good old days.
The machine-to-machine communication, right? All these things are going to be on the network and they're all going to talk.
Right, right.
Right. And they're all going to use 3G, 4G, whatever, 5G that's going to be available.
All the
right?
Gs.
You know, one of the things to remember, though, is a lot of this machine-to-machine communication that happens is not very data-heavy.
Okay.
Right, so there's a little
amount. So really small packets.
Small packets of data being sent, right? Okay. You know, if you think about that little pay terminals and FPOS terminals, and they're all like, you know, they're all 3G, 4G connected, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how much data are they really sending?
True.
So, I mean, the telcos are going to make some money off it, but I mean, I just can't see it, you know, as you need a killer app, you need a killer data consuming app, and maybe that's what it is.
But you're going to have to pay some sort of flag for some sort of monthly access charge, aren't you? I mean, if you've got if I put a SIM card in a vending machine, I'm only sending data, you know, really, really tiny amounts, SMS kind of equivalent data once a day or once an hour or something. So it doesn't cost much. But someone's going to charge me a couple of bucks a month at least to have that SIM card connected, aren't they?
Yeah, so you make a couple of bucks. But I mean, you know, you also got to remember that, you know, you maybe are making a couple of bucks less on the data plans because the data plans have become competitive.
Right.
So, I mean, I mean, the pool has become bigger, but it's not as if like there's a lot. Again, I think the value translates to some extent to how much data you're consuming, right? And I mean, you know, most of the data we consume is via our broadbands, right? Mm-hmm. So,
fascinating. All right, so you're not buying TPG shares, I take it. And we do expect they'll be taken over. I think it's fascinating that the change, you know, if we'd been doing this podcast 5 years ago, we would have absolutely been talking about the hyper growth, or at least the very fast growth of telecommunications. And we may not have expected to see something. A chair advisor, we've recommended TPG twice. We've sold it then twice, the first time on valuation, the second time on the takeover news. Made money on both occasions, happy to say. But broadly speaking, the growth days seem well and truly numbered.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I want to ask you about, I mentioned Hang On by the Seat of Your Pants.
Yes.
I'm tempted to sing a bit of Tony Dancer by Elton John, a bit of Blue Jean Baby, LA Lady, but I won't because I value our listeners and frankly, we can't afford to lose any, but I've given a couple of clues there. Mm. It is the very venerated name of Levi Strauss & Company that finally overnight returned to the public markets after being private for almost 35 years.
Wow.
It's 160-ish years old, I want to say.
Very old.
But it's now back.
It's back!
And the shares rose by 32% after listing. Mm-hmm. Now, neither of us has done a heap of work on Levi's, but we can't let it go without saying, I'm wearing a pair of Levi's. That's how ubiquitous they are.
Mm-hmm.
Are you interested at all in the company? The valuation aside, of course, we have to do that work separately. But one of the very best, biggest, longest surviving and frankly longest thriving brands in the world, I think I want to say. I don't know how many other countries or companies that have kind of that quality of brand have been around for that long. I
Coca-Cola.
Not even 160 years, though, would it? Like, it'd be...
Isn't Coca-Cola around for like...
I want to say 120, 130. Anyway, in any case, there's not many of them, right? Like idea. Like, Levi's is probably one of the first kind of batch of consumer brands. Heinz might make it somewhere close to that, possibly. It's back on the public markets. Shares are up. The market loves it. Are you going to have a look and see whether the shares are interest?
Absolutely not.
Not
a chance.
Why not? I wear Levi's. You wear Levi's. Will's too cool to wear Levi's, but if he wasn't... No, he wears the thumbs up.
I rock Levi's.
Hey, there we go. Come on, Doc. That's 100% of people we've surveyed so far.
Here's a problem, I think, with Levi's. Everybody who wants to own or has a Levi's in their wardrobe has it.
Right.
How often do you buy your Levi's?
As infrequently as I can, and when I do, I buy them online.
Exactly. You buy them online. And
I
you
hate
buy
shopping.
Them, I buy them when they have 2-for-1.
Yep, right.
At Just Jeans. So everybody buys them infrequently. They buy them as cheap as they can.
Yes.
And, where's the really growth? There's no growth. This thing is probably going to grow at, 5%, 3%.
Everything has to grow. Maybe grow a decent rate. It's cheap enough. It's worth buying, isn't it?
I don't know how cheap it is, but it's like growing at 2%.
we grew at 13% last year. We looked at the numbers this morning.
Of course. Everything grows before the IPO.
Oh, okay. We're suggesting there might be some...
I'm not suggesting anything, but
You're more scared of the lawyers than I am.
I don't want the Levi's lawyers to come in Levi's pants getting after me. Right?
We love Levi's for the record.
So, yeah, I love Levi's.
All right, so wear the pants. Don't buy the shares. Is that what you're going with?
Currently, yeah.
Yeah, I said to you this morning, I love kind of the old brand. I'm not a big fad guy, not a big trend guy, and plenty of people who've seen my wardrobe would know exactly what I'm talking about. But I kind of love the old established brands, right? I've worn Levi's on and off since I was a kid. I think I probably will wear them until I die, assuming the company's still around. I want to love it. Like I like the idea of owning shares in kind of such an established stalwart business. But as you say, mate, I said to you this morning, I love the jeans. I want to buy the shares. I just kind of can't because, to your point, you just wonder if they're listing on the market. Frankly, the fact that shares are up a third overnight, the chance that this is going to be a market beating investment got to be pretty low unless they find some way of doing something different, right?
Well, all those people who own the shares pre-IPO are happy.
Yeah, very happy, mate. 30% gain. Yeah. Very happy with that.
Overnight.
Annualize that number.
That's fantastic returns.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we're going to get into the Fool Mailbag, our favourite segment. And by the number of emails and tweets and questions we get from members, we hope, and listeners, and we hope one of your favourite segments as well. As a reminder, you can get in touch with us at The Motley Fool AU on Twitter, our far favourite way to communicate with our listeners because it lets us interact, go back and forth, and it's kind of fun to share it publicly. You can also get me at TMF Scott P, and you can get Doc at Anirban Mahanti, AnirbanMahanti. Or you can hit us up on info@fool.com.au. That out of the way, let's open up the mailbag, Doc.
Let's do it.
First one comes from Gabriel. Hi, Scott and Anirban. Love the podcast. Tell you, he knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's been listening.
He is.
I like that.
The right thing. And actually, he might really love the podcast.
He probably does.
Yeah.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah, he does.
Everyone loves the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Go through that question. Great mix of market insights, he says, and some good old-fashioned banter. Us? Who? What?
banter.
Okay. I have a question that you might be able to tackle on the podcast. I know you both favour a diversified portfolio of companies that meet your filters, and I'd like to know what your view is on fixed income. Do you see fixed income element in complementing this portfolio, specific, of course, to each individual? And how would someone get exposure to fixed income as a retail investor? I checked some managed funds and found the management fees appalling. 0.5 to 0.6% to manage bonds. Ridiculous. We agree, Gabriel. Anyway, that's it. Hope you have time for this on your podcast. Keep up the good work, Gabriel. Gabriel, we do have time. Great question. And of course, we're narcissistic to a fault. So if you think we're great, then we think you're great because that's how the world goes around. So we will answer your question. Doc, you don't strike me as a fixed income kind of guy.
I have an answer for this. You know, number one is that depends. Anybody who says they need income, I say that, you know, you could have income from growth. Right, you just
invest for income from growth.
You just invest for growth, and you just sell some over the. You know, if you need, like, if you want,
it's all too high. Can I just get some dividends, please?
You can. So you can do that, but you know, you can always do growth and still get income.
I see.
And maybe you get ahead by doing that.
Right.
So that's number one. Okay. So that's one approach. The other approach is, of course, you can invest in dividend stocks.
Now, Gabriel's kind of saying here, though, that he wants a diversified portfolio. Yeah. So he's kind of, to some degree, I think, if I read through the question, I think he's saying, well, I want fixed income as part of a diversified portfolio.
Yes,
I've got my growth. Yes, I've got my dividends. Mm. I kind of want fixed income as well. Yep. Is that something you should be doing? And if so, how would you go about it?
Get it. You know, I don't do it. But if you wanted to do it, you could buy some bonds. So you could buy...
James
Bond would be, if you could buy James Bond, that would be awesome. If you could buy James Bond, that would be really awesome. I would buy some James Bond if I could, but no. So you could buy bonds issued by companies. Mm-hmm. You could buy government bonds. They don't really pay much, but you could buy emerging market government bonds, for example, if you believe that they're going to return you the money.
Sure, because Venezuela's been great.
Yeah, then you can get 15% return. So, you know,
you can get nothing.
Yeah. You could do that. Mm-hmm. In the US, they even have municipal bonds.
Right.
You could buy those. I mean, actually.
Which is the equivalent of kind of state government bonds for the most part, sometimes council kind of.
Sometimes like council level bonds, right?
Right.
So you could buy those. Many of these pay, you know, 5, 6, 7% rates of return.
Money for jam.
Money. Well, you know, they come with some certain risks attached. So that's one option.
Right.
Bank hybrids here is another option.
True.
Then you've got, you know, could do your usual term.
So bank hybrids are products issued by the banks that are effectively have the characteristics of income because they pay a fixed income. Almost like preferred shares, they pay a fixed income amount. Some can be converted, some can't, into shares down the track.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're set somewhere between debt and equity in sort of the hierarchy of things, right?
I would argue it has the worst of both worlds for what it's worth. That's a whole different rant.
That's a different rant. So, I mean, yeah, if you really want to do it, there are many, many options, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've got access to a platform that gives you access to all sorts of bonds and, you know, then, yeah, you definitely can. You can search for them.
I am going to echo some of your earlier thoughts, Doc. So here's my thing. I love the idea of diversified portfolios, but I'm squarely against the idea of a Noah's Ark portfolio. And what I call Noah's Ark portfolios, when you have to have two of everything, right? Diversification doesn't mean have some of everything in equal proportion, even unequal proportions. At some point, then all you get is mediocrity, right? Airlines are a terrible business in my view. Resources are a relatively terrible business in my view. I'm not going to have two of those just because I feel like I should for diversification's sake. So I love diversification, but don't fall into the trap of thinking diversification equals some of everything. You end up just kind of chasing mediocrity at that level. And frankly, once you've done that, you might as well buy an index and go home. Which also, by the way, is fine if that's what you're into. If you'd rather just buy an index and go to the beach, go fishing, go to the shops, then go for it. If you're looking, though, to build a portfolio using your own steam, I would be diversified to make sure you're not exposed to any particular risk or set of risks within your portfolio. So having four banks is not diversification, if I need to be clear about that. But also, too, having two everything, just as I said, leads you to mediocrity. If you're not going to beat the market with, we talked about utilities before, right? Utilities are generally not going to beat the market. If your aim is to beat the market, don't buy utilities because you're not going to do it. And don't have them just because you feel like you need to be diversified. So fixed income, depends where you are in your life. You mentioned, Gabriel, that we can't give personal advice, and that's dead true. If you're in a situation where you're starting to draw down an income out of your retirement portfolio, for example, there may be an excuse for some degree of fixed income, whether that's in bonds or cash or term deposits or something else, or dividends, quite frankly. But I would have to go a very, very long way before recommending that people include bonds in their portfolio, and certainly not just for the purpose of diversification. So I hope that makes sense. Doc's giving you some options. And you're right too, by the way, mate. The costs of these things are extraordinarily high relative to the return you're getting. So I just don't see enough reason to jump down that rabbit hole personally.
Motley Fool Money.
Doc, an email from Nick.
Mm-hmm. What does Nick want?
Well, good thing is Nick also has read the memo.
Yes.
So he says, hi, team. Love the podcast, of course. Of course
hey,
you do.
Good man, Nick.
And he asks an interesting question, which I haven't come across before. He says, what do you make of the upcoming, so there's an upcoming float, and it's called the Pengana Capital ASX listed, oh, sorry, it's ASX listed. It's the Pengana Capital Global Private Equity Trust with about 600 holdings. From what I read, it seems like an interesting or innovative way to access the huge global private investment market traded on the ASX. He says in brackets, at a 1.25 percentage fee and performance. Now, Pengana is a business that is owned in large part by Soul Patts, so I will disclose I own Soul Pattinson's shares, just to get that right out of the way. Interesting though, mate, the whole private equity market, there's been an enormous explosion in the number and, frankly, the amount of money being put towards pre-IPO companies.
Mm-hmm.
Japan's SoftBank had, it's a $100 billion US fund.
Yep.
There's an extraordinary amount of money going into the public, the private markets. And to that extent, when Uber, for example, lists, and we'll talk about Uber in maybe next week or the week after, when it lists, it'll list with something like a $100 billion valuation. Back in the old days, companies would be listing at a tenth of that, if that, because that was the best way for them to access capital. There's so much money now going to the private markets, they're staying private a whole lot longer. Now, given that's the case, from the $10 billion to $100 billion opportunity was kept away from you and me because we're not private market investors. But the IPO guys, the venture capitalists, the private equity investors, they got that gain. Is it sensible? Does it make sense to start looking for ways that individual investors can access the private market, something like this Pengana Fund?
All right. So this is a very, very, this could be a whole podcast. Right? This is a complicated question.
We haven't got time for that. Let's do that.
We don't have that kind of time. So I'm going to try to keep it short.
Thank you.
So number one, I think for all the reasons that you stated, I think there is some value, actually lots of value in the private space, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of money in the private space. A lot of companies today mm-hmm. are not going public, and they're going public much later in their life.
Correct.
So therefore, one way to tap the growth of some of the most innovative companies is actually to invest in the private market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question really here is that if this fund or any other fund, for the matter of fact, can give you access to some of the best. So it comes down to, again, the ability of the fund managers to have access, right? It's mm-hmm. a question of having the access, and then invest at attractive terms. Mm-hmm. If they're doing that, then this could be a great way to earn returns. But, you know, how do you really know that, right? I mean, that's something that you need to do the due diligence to. You need to see the type, I guess a couple of things, type of companies they're investing in, what sort of information do you have about them, who are the other people they're investing with, right? Most investments in interesting companies have other big partners that you know, and well-known names that you can identify. If that's the case, then this is great. But if it's not, I mean, you don't know, right? There's hundreds and hundreds of companies that are private.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, not all my, it's just like the equity markets, right? Not all companies are worth investing. Mm. The equity markets are large. So again, the hard part might be to actually do the due diligence, and you might just have to accept the fact that you have to believe in the lead investors and their ability to find the right investments. And if you do that, then maybe that's okay.
Right. I think that's right. But I think, you know, the question here is that, the reason that I'm saying the concept might be interesting or even attractive is that lots of those companies are getting lots of value. And using Uber as an example, it's probably a nice common example, but frankly, it also makes it look like it's an easy thing to do, right? Hey, if I can get Uber at $10 billion, then get to $100 billion, I'll make a fortune. That's absolutely true. Of course, there are plenty of PE companies that never, ever make it to the public markets for very good reasons, because they run out of cash or they're just generally crap businesses. So at some level, I think it's, you know, It's an attractive idea. People want to be engaged and invested in the next Uber, the next Lyft, the next whatever, and that's absolutely right. We know that private equity, though, has a terrible track record on average in terms of their strike rate, but a wonderful track record, generally speaking, on the average return they get, because for every Facebook, you can afford to have a dozen or 20 failures and still make a lot of money. So that's why it's attractive. I think to your point, Doc, you have to believe the fund manager specifically brings something to the table. Pengana's not being offered anything particularly attractive that no one else is being offered. And so at some level, they're going to get the same return as everybody else. And so if you're paying them a 1.2, 1.25% fee plus an outperformance fee if they beat the benchmark, which apparently looks like 8% based on the PDS I'm looking at here. You know, it's not, hey, if they do it, it's worth it, right? If they can beat the market and give you a really good return, then fantastic. If it's just another way for them to make some money and maybe not you to make some money, then that maybe not a wonderful idea. I would, generally speaking, with most managed funds, we know most of them lose to the market over time. So I would just be a little bit careful because fees tend to be the difference. Even the good managers, by the time you've taken out 1.25% plus outperformance, very, very tough to beat the market over time. Pengana might be the exception that proves the rule, but we know it's something like 75% to 80% of funds actually lose to the market after fees. So just be a little bit careful about where you're jumping. The idea is attractive. Whether it ends up being a good investment is probably a bigger question. I'd probably give it some time to perform on the market first, check it out. Like everything, there's no hurry, right? Give it some time. It's going to list in April. Apparently, once it lists, you can have a bit of a look and see what you think.
Yeah, and have a look at what they've invested in, right? I mean, if they're investing in some of the, you know, businesses you want to be invested in, right, maybe then it's worthwhile. The other thing I'll quickly point out, I actually did not know this, 8% seems like a bit of a low hurdle.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, 1.25% you're already taking, right? That's your base fee. If you do 9%, you're going to take a performance fee on the difference of the percentage. I mean, you could be underperforming the market if there's not a huge outperformance here. If there's a huge outperformance here, then fine.
Yep.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, one last question comes from Alex on Twitter. Alex says, hey, Scott, love the podcast. Hey.
Hey, Alex.
Doing well.
We love Alex.
I've been listening for a long time now and learnt a lot. I wonder if he's talking about someone else's podcast.
Oh, it must be ours.
Maybe you got the person wrong. Maybe you had to send it to somebody else.
Come on, I'm very confident.
Sure it's us?
Yeah, yes.
All right. We do our best.
And he loves us.
I know, but if he's, well, he thinks he loves, maybe he thinks talking about someone else. Maybe it's another podcast he's listening to. Maybe it's Serial. Anyway, okay. He says, my question to you and Doc is, how correlated are big market sell-offs to earnings season reports due to high expectations that don't become reality? Great question. On the back of earnings season, we're only a couple of weeks out. It feels like a million years ago now, mate. It's been 3 weeks since earnings season, and the relief of that wipes a lot of the bad memories away from the late nights and plenty of effort getting through all this stuff. When it comes to earnings reports, are sell-offs either at a company or market level tend to be correlated to big sell-offs, and what would drive those things?
Yeah, so I think at a company level, for sure. Like, I mean, you know, if a company has a bad report and it's, you know, I'll rephrase that. It's all about expectations.
Yes.
So it's more about the expectations. If the expectations were for a certain report and the expectation wasn't met, then depending on how much do you miss? Like, I mean, almost if you see if there's an operating profit expectation missed by 20%, the shares will fall by 20% approximately, right? So that's the thing. And again, if the expectation of a outperformance was there and you outperformed even that by another 20%, the shares might rise by 20%. Mm-hmm. And so I think we see that pretty regularly. I mean, you know, there's a plus and minuses here that happens. I think the market is very, very good in general in digesting short-term news, right? The news that comes out, it's pretty good in digesting that. It is good at digesting that with reference to what it was thinking before that. Mm-hmm. And we saw plenty of that this earnings season. So I think he's right. I mean, the overall market sell-offs, they do happen more, I think, in relation to, you know, if you have a series of bad results, if there's some economic news, or, you know, the rates went up, the rates went down, those sort of things, or something big happens, you know, doesn't even have to happen in Australia, it could happen externally, and those things have big, or if the world markets sell off, then our market might just decide to sell off, just because the world market has sell off. So those, at a market level, those things happen. Mm-hmm. At a company-specific level, there is a good correlation there between expectations and the outcomes that you see in the report. Mm.
Generally speaking, Alex, history tends to suggest that, to Doc's point, at company by company level, they tend to be pretty correlated. Disappointments or positive surprises, what we call that, tend to be reflected in the share prices pretty quickly and often same day or next day. And the swings can be big based on expectations, as Doc said. So much whether the profit's growing or declining, you figure that should determine it. But because the market's already looking forward, the market's already, to use the jargon, pricing in that result. So Brickworks, for example, this week, good example. Profit was up. Sorry, New Hope, I'll use New Hope Coal. Profit was up, I want to say 40%. Shares actually fell on the day because the market had already expected that growth and the outlook wasn't great.
Yeah.
And so you've got this combination of, you know, 40% growth, that's got to be great for the share price. Well, if you check out the share price graph, the shares have gone up in anticipation of that already. Mm. And so it's the new news that the market's responding to, or the change versus what they expected. That's often true. When it comes to the market as a whole, though, Doc, your point, absolutely. In the, particularly in the short to medium term, we tend to flick around based on what's happening overseas. The market in Australia tends to follow overnight leads from the US, for example, slavishly and stupidly, in my view, but then there you go. Similarly, commodity prices, that's a whole other rant. I've got a couple of rants backed up already. Mate, are you going to give us a rant, by the way, in a minute?
No.
Haven't got it? Not feeling it?
I'm not feeling. I feel the, you know, the questions are great. Okay. I love the questions.
It's cathartic.
No.
All right. But over the long term, I will say the market, generally speaking, foresees economic weakness that leads to profit falls. So while in on a company-by-company basis, on a short-term basis, absolutely share prices flick around based on earnings, over the long term, you tend to find that if the market is expecting the economy as a whole to do poorly and therefore, for the most part, share prices to fall because profits are going to fall as a whole, the market tends to foresee that rather than reacting to it. And so it's one of those things, the old phrase, if you're going to panic, panic early, tends to apply because by the time everyone knows the news, the share prices have already fallen and then it's too late. Now, I will countenance that with something exactly opposite. So I'll talk out of both sides of my mouth. Generally speaking, the correlation between GDP and share markets is very, very weak. And so if you take a particular year's performance, 2018, 2020, 1995, whatever year, generally speaking, the correlation between, hey, GDP was positive, therefore the share price was ... And the answer is nobody knows. There is no direct correlation between the movements of both of those. So frankly, I think, you know, Howard, I think I might have said this in a previous podcast, Doc, Howard Marks says there are things that are, he's a famous US investor, says there are things that are really important, but unknowable. And so you just simply can't do anything about them. If you know them, of course you would do something, but you can't know them. They're not available. They're not possible. So you just kind of can't respond to them. So yes, it would love to know what will happen with share prices based on X, Y, or Z. But GDP is not one of those that really makes a whole heap of sense. And I think that's where you want to be just a little bit careful about how you treat the market and treat expectations. Focus on the long term. Don't try and... Riding the wave is painful and stressful and emotionally taxing, but it still remains, unfortunately, because it'd be nice to not be able to do something different, the very best way to invest for the long term is just simply buy to hold. Keep holding as long as your thesis remains solid. You'll have some really terrible years. You'll have some really wonderful years. And overall, history suggests that the market goes up over time. And so rather than trying to guess and get in and get out at the right times, just simply investing, buying to hold, it's about the right thing to do.
Couldn't agree more.
That's a good way to finish, mate. We didn't mention Apple this podcast.
You just like
too
agreement.
Too bad, run out of time.
You just like agreement. That's all you like.
I like when you agree with me, mate, because it means you're right.
Okay. Well, does that mean you are right?
Yeah, of course.
You like confirmation bias.
No, I'm always right. So when you agree with me, then we're both right.
It's just confirmation bias.
But I'm right anyway. I don't need confirmation bias. I just want you to feel you're right, because you know that if I'm right, you're right.
I'm right, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe our listeners are right.
If they listen to us, they are.
Yeah, that's true.
By definition.
Yeah, that's,
they're very smart people.
Yeah, and they love us. That's
smart,
important.
Funny, good looking. Hey, I will say one last thing. I got a really great email during the week from Inga, who I haven't got the email directly in front of me, but since you mentioned our readers being smart and funny, interesting and good looking, I thought I'd mention Inga. Inga listens to the podcast. She loves what we're doing, which is very nice of her. She also, though, took my advice from last week's rant, maybe not as a result of last week's rant, but in general, took my advice, and she's renegotiated her mortgage rate.
Hey, well done.
She saved something like 0.3% on her rate. Now, on a 30-year, $500,000 mortgage, that'll save her about 30 grand.
That's like a new car.
It's the price of a new car. Oof. I said that last week. This is the, for all the time and all the effort people go to do all the stuff in their lives, I won't do this normal rant, don't worry. She has done a spectacularly smart, good thing. Didn't cost her as much or probably take as much effort as she thought it might. So here's my call out for our listeners. I would love us to start a movement here, Doc. I want to be a force for good for our listeners and for everybody. So if you've renegotiated your rate, if you're going to or if you have done it, please hit us up on Twitter @TheMotleyFoolAU and let us know. Let us know that you've renegotiated your rate. Let us know what your new rate is. Give some encouragement to your fellow fools and your fellow non-yet-fools who don't necessarily know this. We'll retweet everybody who tweets at us @TheMotleyFoolAU and says, hey, I got a lower rate and here's what I got. We will put your name up in lights. We want to share the goodness that is lower mortgage rates. We want you to pay less. the banks to make a little bit less because
you just hate the banks. That's
you hate them. You don't want them to make a profit.
I hate people getting screwed by the banks. Oh, they'll make plenty of profit. Don't worry about that, mate. There's plenty of cash to go around.
Just trying to make them, you know, making their lives hard.
At the Motley Fool AU, please. the episode's almost finished, so just last couple of minutes to go, and then please jump on Twitter. If you want to jump on Facebook, we're at Facebook at The Motley Fool AU as well. The Motley Fool Australia, I think it is actually. Just search Motley Fool Australia, you'll find us. Email us at info@fool.com.au if you don't have either of those social channels. But please hit us up. Let us know what you've saved. Give your fellow fools some encouragement. We could all do with paying a little bit less on our mortgages, I reckon.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
That does wrap us up. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast, and you should, through iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app. And if you'd like what we're doing, please give us a big rating, a bit of a review, help other people find us as well. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/Triple M.
Triple M. Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.